Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Don Bettinelli.
And I'm Olivia Bettinelli.
So, folks, if you listened to last week's episode, which most of you probably did, you know that I just lost my father when we recorded, just hours before we recorded last time. It seems like that's a year ago. It seems like so long ago now. In the intervening week, we have had the wake and the funeral. And so I thought we would talk a little bit about that. But first, maybe talk a little bit about today, where we had, we're all sick now. So
all five kids are sick.
All five kids are sick. They'd all suddenly, they've basically been sick since summer camp a month ago.
Well, just they all got better, and then they all got worse.
In waves. Yeah, it's coming and going in waves. So, like, I don't think Sophie ever really got over her cough.
She's mostly over it, and then now she's sick again.
Yeah. So, your prayers for that would be appreciated, because it's going to be, it's already been a long week, and it's going to be another long couple of days while they get over this. So, we should talk about the wake and funeral, I guess. We had the wake for my dad on Thursday. The funeral was on Friday. He had died the previous Sunday. And, the big thing was telling my mom. As I think I mentioned, my mom is in a nursing home. She is in advanced stages of dementia, so her grasp on reality, on remembering things from day to day is pretty tenuous, and we weren't sure how she would take it. Yeah, you know, I was convinced it'd probably kill her. Like, she'd be so devastated that, you know, how, you know, they talk about couples, one dies and another one dies soon after. So I was afraid that she would take it really bad. But we talked to her doctor, who's a actually this very Catholic doctor. She's a Opus Dei numerary, I guess. But very spiritual, very knowledgeable about faith as well as medicine. And she said, no, she's capable of receiving the news. Go ahead and tell her. You know, she gave some tips on how to prepare and all that sort of stuff. She talked about putting a picture of my dad in her room, you know, with his birthday and the day of his death, and, you know, rest in peace, and making it clear what it is. And we asked for lots of prayers, and she took it really well. I mean, surprisingly well, by all accounts. I wasn't there. I was at home working, but
yeah, you went to the doctor. You were at the doctor's
office.
That's
right. I wasn't working. I was at the doctor's office. Right. I would have been there. Yeah. I had to get, I had a couple of doctor's appointments this week that I'd been waiting for and had been rescheduled already. I needed to go to, but, yeah, that's right. So
it's been a long week.
Like I said, it's been a long week. She took it really well. And I attribute that to the prayers. Really?
Yes, definitely.
We had so many people praying. You've talked to your friends on social media, people from all over the country praying for her. So that worked out really well. So Thursday we had the wake, and my dad's older siblings. Remember, my dad was 89. He has two older brothers and two younger sisters still alive. It's just amazing. Gives me hope for me. And they all came, of course, to the but the funny thing about wakes is just how many people come that you haven't seen in years.
Mm-hmm.
There were people there that I have not seen in 30 years, 40 years from when I was a kid, who came. Just amazing to see people after all this time. And there's a lot of standing. My feet were really tired. the head of receiving line, you know, so and there's a script for how this happens, how we do things like wakes, right? The mm-hmm. people come in, they kneel at the coffin, they say a prayer, they come up to you. I'm so sorry for your loss. Thank you very much. Thank you for coming. You know, it can feel awkward for everyone. What else do you say? You know, and but we all know it. You know, it's the thing we all do. So there's no need to feel too awkward because we all feel awkward. It's not something we're used to. We want to be doing. So how are the kids handling it? Our kids. Mostly okay.
Yeah,
it's the first person they've known closely who's died.
Yeah, it's been hard for them, I guess, but I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a few times with, you know, some of them with tears at different points, and yeah, it's funny. My brother John, his family has an exchange student, this poor girl, high school girl from Chile.
Argentina.
Right. The previous one. There was a previous one from Chile. From Argentina. Are you sure? I thought she was from Chile.
I could be wrong.
I think she's from Chile. Well, anyway, she was from South America. And she gets to go through this whole... I mean, that's what being an exchange student is about. Experiencing a different culture. All parts of it. You know, which you're living with a family. But she had to go to this wake and the funeral.
Isabella spent a lot of time talking to her at the wake, which was really kind.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was, I mean, I think Bella really enjoyed talking to her. I think she kind of made a new friend. So,
right.
So that was really nice. Yeah. So Italian wakes are a thing. They're very interesting. You and I talked about the difference between Northern wakes and Southern wakes. Northern wakes don't have food.
All of my friends from other parts of the country were kind of shocked that I said that there was no food.
Not at the wake. There'll be food, like, after the funeral, but, like, not at the wake. Which would have been nice to have food at the wake because... It was a long time. And, you know, and it started at 4:15, which is dinner time, and goes to 8 o'clock.
Which is way after dinner
time. Which is way after dinner time. So we had to eat really... We had to stop at Taco Bell and get food for the kids before.
And we were actually kind of late.
Not too late. It was fine. But yeah,
but we missed the private family viewing time, which would have been a little bit nice.
It would have been. Yeah.
Because by the time we were there, like, you had to sort of jump into the receiving line. Like, you didn't have time to be, like, just there with your family.
Right. That's true. There were some of my siblings had made up poster boards with pictures of my dad.
And there was a nice...
And there was a video, like a slideshow.
Slideshow.
Yeah. My sister kept wanting to put music to it, but you don't put music to it at a wake, I guess. So that was the wake. The funeral on a Friday was very nice. So we'd start by going to the funeral home, have a final viewing and prayers. And the priest who came to say prayers at the wake was Father John Grieco, who he's apparently a podcaster. And I think I've heard of his podcast before. I'd have to look it up again. So it's kind of interesting, but he knows my brother and his wife. But so the funeral mass on Friday, Immaculate Conception Church in Stoughton, where Father Carlos Suarez, who's a friend, is the pastor. So that was really nice. Father Chip Hines, who you might know from other StarQuest shows, who's also a friend of mine, he can celebrate it. And we had the funeral mass there. And was one of the really nice things was my brother John gave the family remembrance at the end of the mass, the quote-unquote eulogy. But we don't do eulogies in the Catholic Church. We do remembrances after the end of mass. And it was really good. In fact, I'm going to record it and put it at the end of the podcast. It's kind of long, so I don't want to put it right in the middle and slow things down. But if you're interested, you know, stick around to the end.
It was so good. It was one of the best things I've heard. And Father Chip actually said,
in 18 years of being a priest, it's the best eulogy he's ever heard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was good.
If you listen to it, I mean, I think it's pretty much a perfect encapsulation of the Christian mystery of discipleship, the death of a disciple who, you know, not a saint. My dad was not a saint. He was, you know, a sinner like the rest of us. And, but he also had conversion throughout his life. So, you know, there's a, it's really good. And my brother kind of weaved in the theme of love that my dad had for others, that others had for him, that Christ has for us. Yeah, you'll really enjoy it. So if you get a chance to stick around to the end and give a listen to that. Then the interment, he was being buried at the Massachusetts National Cemetery. It's a military cemetery in the town of Bourne on Cape Cod at the Joint Forces Base, Cape Cod. It's a military base down there. And so we drive down. It's about an hour drive. And so we caravaned. We processed it down. Not caravaned. Processed it down. I know. Processed down. And it was really nice. It's beautiful for one thing. Like the location was really nice. Very, well, military precision, the way they do everything. They, you know, you pull up, you park in a place, they greet you. It's very precise. Then they lead you through to a particular interment chapel. So you don't go to where he's going to be buried, but to a little outdoor chapel area where an honor guard is there. So whichever branch of the military the deceased was in, they have an honor guard for them there. So my dad was in the Navy, so there was a couple of Navy officers and a petty officer there. My nephew, who's a first lieutenant in the Army, took part in the ceremony as well. So the funeral director led the graveside service, and he led the prayers, but he also read a poem, and I am going to read that one here. And it was such a really good poem, perfect for my dad, perfect for a Navy man. And it also reminds me a little bit of Tolkien, and I'll read it for you. It's by Henry Van Dyke, and it's called Gone From My Sight. I am standing upon the seashore, a ship at my side, spreads her white sails to the moving breeze and starts for the blue ocean. She's an object of beauty and strength. I stand and watch her until, at length, she hangs like a speck of white cloud, just where the sea and sky come to mingle with each other. Then someone at my side says, "There, she is gone." "Gone where?" "Gone from my sight, that is all. She is just as large in mast, hull, and spar as she was when she left my side. And she is just as able to bear her load of living freight to her destined port. Her diminished size is in me, not in her. And just at the moment when someone says, "There, she is gone," there are other eyes watching her coming and other voices ready to take up the glad shout, "Here she comes," and that is dying. So, pretty good poem.
Yeah, I kind of feel like the last line is extraneous and you could just cut it.
And that is dying?
Yeah, I think it's extraneous. I don't think it's necessary.
Well, I think he's trying to make sure that people know what he's writing about.
Right, but you don't need to.
Maybe.
I think it weakens the poem, honestly. If I was like the editor who was printing it, I would say, cut that line.
Okay, well, in any case.
No, it's good, but
just. Yeah. So the poem itself, it reminds me a bit of like the elves leaving Lindon, heading into the Outer West, heading, you know, back to the Valar and in the Lord of the Rings, you know, as they go over the horizon and, you know, they take up the glad shout, "Here she comes." So really, yeah, it was a powerful moment and very moving to me. They have the whole, so, you know, they play taps, they fold the flag. The flag is presented. In this case, it was presented to my older brother, Bernie, who's the oldest. And then we went back to a restaurant for some food and fellowship. Yeah. And that was it. I mean, it was a long...
It's a very long day.
Long day. Yeah, I mean, long day for the kids. We had to make sure we packed sandwiches in the car and snacks and stuff, because it was like we left the house at 9, didn't get back till after 5, I think, 6 or something like that.
After 5.
Yeah. So it was a long day out, a long emotional day. But yeah, it's going to be weird. I mean, as anyone who's lost anyone knows, you have these moments where you kind of, you're thinking, oh, they would love this, or, oh, I wish I could say that. And you can't. So, you know, it's going to be, odd for a while, as anyone knows. So, yeah, that's that. Any other, did I miss anything? I think that's about it. I heard from so many of you. It was very nice. Some people offering their condolences, people saying that the remembrances of him from that we had from last week was meaningful to them and helped them with their own memories of loss. So it was really nice. So and I appreciate it. Thank you. All right. How do you segue from that? You don't.
Well, in your family, life goes on, and Saturday, the day after the funeral,
right?
We actually, not the menfolk, because this is one of those ceremonies that's peculiar to women. We had a bridal shower for your nephew.
My nephew's
John Paul.
Fiance, right.
So they're getting married right at Thanksgiving. And this bridal shower has been planned for quite some time. And, well, life goes on. And I think everybody was glad to have a reason to celebrate, because life is such that mourning and gladness oftentimes go hand in hand, side by side. You know, the Bible says there's a time for everything under heaven, and sometimes those times butt up against each other.
Yes, they in fact they often do. Yeah,
and curiously enough, the menu at the bridal shower was very similar to that at the post funeral
the luncheon,
but both Italian.
Yeah,
go figure,
surprise.
That was nice. It was another, it was kind of long, but it was good to see people.
That's good. Yeah. So we're looking forward to that. It was really nice. I saw that my nephew John Paul is getting married in November, but my other nephew, Joe, his brother, got married back in August. And like I mentioned, my mom is in a nursing home and couldn't go. So apparently today, Joe and his wife, Beth, went to the nursing home in their tux and her gown to show my mom, to kind of bring the wedding to her, because she couldn't go to the wedding. And they posted a nice picture online. It was really sweet of them. It was really nice that they went and did that. And I'm sure they were the hit of the nursing home.
Yeah.
Joe doesn't like being the center of attention at all, does he? We love Joe. Joe is the best. But he's a character. All of John's kids are characters. So that was, that was really nice. Also, you know what was really nice also was to see Amanda. So my dad, I think I mentioned last week, my dad, and my mom and dad divorced 35, almost 40 years ago now. And my dad had remarried, and they had 3 daughters. So I have 3 half sisters, and the oldest is Amanda. And I haven't really seen them much in recent years, especially. But it was Amanda was heavily involved in the, you know, being, you know, taking the things that went around the wake and the funeral and that sort of stuff. So it was nice to see her, spend time with her, support her. You know, I lost my dad, but her mom has already died, so she's doesn't have a mom or dad now. So it's hard. Like harder for her, especially. So it was nice to see her and her sisters there and to connect with them. So All right. Like I said, I don't know how to transition, so I'm just going to segue right into talking about food. Because, you know, what makes you feel better than food? We didn't get a chance to talk about stuff we've been making last week, but there's a couple things I want to mention. I got this recipe for barbecue baked beans on the smoker. These aren't from scratch beans. These are like open cans of pork and beans. And then doctor them up. So this recipe comes from How to Barbecue Right. Malcolm Reed is the cook, and his YouTube channel is How to Barbecue Right. And so it's like cans of pork, some pork and beans, an onion, brown sugar, some barbecue sauce, ketchup, mustard, Worcestershire sauce, and some barbecue rub, all mixed together. And then you just put it on the smoker for 2-3 hours. It was pretty good. I liked it.
It was tasty.
Yeah, it was pretty tasty. I mean, even for having come out of a can, you know.
Honestly, I think that when you do beans from scratch, they can often end up tough if the beans aren't fresh enough. If they're old, they can be tough.
Yeah.
And so I think that doing it from the can allows you to focus on the flavor as opposed to worrying about whether or not your beans are going to end up inedible, because you can put all the right flavorings on them. But if the beans are just too old, you're going to end up with something that's tough and inedible. And that's happened to us too many times.
Can you soak them longer? Will that help?
I don't think so.
No. Yeah. So it was good. I might put a little less barbecue rub. Malcolm's a little heavy on the barbecue rub, I've noticed in his recipes, but it was flavorful. It was good, so I liked it. The problem with our smoker is like the way he's got a big smoker, so he can put the beans on and then put other stuff on next to it. There's no room for that on ours. Like the beans pretty much take up the whole smoker. So anyway, I'm not asking for another smoker.
No,
I'm not getting one.
No.
So barbecue baked beans on the smoker. Then I made a soup that I've been looking at for a while. I had a few different recipes of it that I was working from, but it was called chicken khao soi, and it's a Thai chicken soup. And it's kind of curried. It's not just kind of, it's a curried soup. So it starts with, interestingly enough, Mexican chiles, guajillo chiles or New Mexico chiles that are dried that you rehydrate. And then you take the chilies, then the some shallots, garlic, ginger, cilantro stems, which is interesting, some coriander, turmeric, curry powder, and then some of the liquid that you soak the chilies in a food processor. And you keep adding that liquid until it becomes like a smooth paste. Then you cook that paste. Because in Thai curries, you cook the paste before you do anything. It's very interesting how it is different from other curries. And then you add coconut milk and chicken broth. Then you add chicken to it. And then you simmer it until the chicken is tender. You take it out. You shred the chicken. And then you add back the chicken, some fish sauce, and some brown sugar. And then you also serve it with some lo mein noodles, Chinese egg noodles. And you cook those separately, put them in a bowl, and then pour the soup over it. Now, you liked it, but you thought there was too much fish sauce.
Way too much fish sauce.
Yeah, I think I added some extra fish sauce because it wasn't salty enough. But I think next time I'll just add salt instead of fish sauce.
Or soy sauce.
Yeah, I could add soy sauce. Yeah, that could work too.
In general, my rule of thumb is usually to take like half of a fish sauce in a recipe and substitute soy sauce for it, because I like a little fish sauce. I don't like a lot of fish sauce.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of like the funkiness of it, but yeah, I get it. Well, the other thing too is it was kind of spicy, and if I didn't want it as spicy, I think next time I might omit the chilies. Like, I would soak the chilies to get that liquid, but not put the chilies into the paste, just put the liquid into the paste. So the soaking water soaks up some of the spiciness, but not all of it. So that might be an interesting way of doing it. I don't know.
Maybe.
Yeah. Or just use less chili.
It wanted more, I think, of the like fresh something. Like I wanted more crunch and more fresh flavor.
It needed some vegetables, carrots. Yeah. It needed, it could use carrots, mushrooms. I could have added celery or cabbage, like some Napa cabbage might have been good. Yeah. Yeah.
It wanted something a little bit more.
Yeah. If I make it again, I'm going to make some adjustments on it. So you made, for dinner tonight, you made, because if everyone's sick, it's time for soup. You made some, chicken stock in the Instant Pot and then made some Zuppa Toscana from it.
Yeah. One of my friends mentioned Zuppa Toscana and, that said sounded good. So I went for it.
So describe Zuppa Toscana again.
So Zuppa Toscana, in the Italian form, in Italy, it's called Zuppa di Pane, I think.
Right.
Or Mistra di Pane.
Minestra di Pane.
Minestra di Pane. And which means soup, bread, like vegetable basically bread soup.
Vegetable bread soup, yeah.
So in the Italian version, it's just like onions, carrots, celery, potatoes, tomato pulp, but not like liquid, and cannellini beans, and then just with like a really simple broth, and then you serve it on toasted bread.
Right.
The American version has heavy cream and adds, see, the Italian version has bacon. The American version adds Italian sausage and heavy cream and, something else, I forget. Anyway, my version was kind of more the American version, although I omitted the bacon and just went with the Italian sausage.
Right.
I didn't put any tomatoes in it. And, but I did add a lot of lemon. I added the juice and zest of a lemon to it.
Mm-hmm.
I also added a lot of wine because I really like chickeny soups that are more wine flavored.
Okay. Winey.
Still with this heavy cream, it's supposed to have kale in it. And we had only a tiny little bit of kale. Most of the kale had turned to the dark side. So mm-hmm. I substituted baby spinach for the rest of the kale. It came out really good.
Yeah, it was good. I mean, despite sick children poking at it, it was good. It was very tasty.
For the croutons, I had some leftover olive loaf, olive bread, like a nice hearty sourdough bread with olives and garlic in it that we'd got at the farmer's market. And I cubed that and toasted it and tossed it with some olive oil and Parmesan cheese and some herbs. And that was really good in the soup.
You know, Milk Street Kitchen had an article not too long ago where they talked about the Italian version of that soup, which is, you know, what we have with cream and all that other stuff. And it actually looked really good. And I was going to track it down again, but I forgot to do it. And before we recorded it now, I can't find it quickly on their website, but yeah, it was good. I enjoyed it. It was, a nice, we've actually been having a lot of soups lately, haven't we?
We have. The weather has turned. It's now October and it's cool and it feels like soup weather.
It does. It does. I made the Vietnamese meatball and watercress soup that I've talked about before this week. I also made chicken and dumplings last night, which I hadn't done before. And that was pretty good. I substituted, it wanted chicken breasts, but you know how expensive chicken breasts are these days. So I just substituted boneless chicken thighs and that worked out pretty good in it. But yeah, I like that.
I think it wanted a little bit more flavor punch, but.
Yeah, it could use some lemon. That also could use some lemon. Yeah. Again, lemon, chicken and lemon.
Chicken and lemon,
they go together.
A good combination.
They go together like chicken and lemon. In any case, yeah, so that's what we've been eating. Let's talk about what we've been watching. We have been watching a lot, given that it's been 2 weeks since we talked about what we were watching. So let's talk about The Rookie. As you may know, we are fans of the Nathan Fillion TV show, The Rookie, where he's a cop. It's the fifth season just premiered. Can you imagine it's been five seasons?
Yeah, that's a lot.
That's a while. That's wild. It's been so long.
He's not really a rookie anymore.
He's not the rookie. There are other rookies, apparently. But and now he's going to become a training officer, so there will be rookies he's training.
Right.
He's going to have like an entire career, like a 20-year pension by the time this show is done. Maybe not. But one of the things we observed was how uneven the episodes are, like, but from one episode to the next. That, like, some episodes are just really good. They're really fun or just really powerful, well-written. And other episodes, like, okay, there's a huge plot hole, totally unbelievable dialogue there. It kind of dragged. It's very uneven. Like, you can, like, on most shows, you can tell, like, the writers, there's a writer, but the writer's room evens things out. With this one, you can really tell that some of the writers in the writer's room are quality writers, and some of them are not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The season opener for this season was not my favorite. They brought back a character who I feel has outlived her usefulness. Like, I feel like we've seen her too many times. She's a serial killer who they keep coming back to over and over again. And I feel like we've told her story enough times. I don't feel like she's got more story to tell. And I'm tired. Like, she's no longer feels scary. And when your scary, super creepy serial killer no longer feels scary, they're done.
She's not scary because you're familiar with her. You know, you've seen her too often. And this just was so improbable. The situations that, like, how would that happen? How would they get access to that?
They did not build the scenario well, and it felt like no way.
Contrived.
No, this is contrived. Would never happen. That they would never do that.
Like, you can always tell the problem is when a major thing happens off screen, like they escape from something or they get out of something, but they don't show it to you because it's improbable. It's impossible, probably. And so, they managed to do this impossible thing, but we're not showing it to you because we don't want to have to figure out how to write that. Like, it's just cheating. So, yeah. But nevertheless, Nathan Fillion is always a joy to watch. This character is a great character. And the supporting cast, I pretty much like. I mean, the cast has changed over the years, but I really feel like right now this cast is really good. There's no one, I'm trying to think if there's any of the characters that I really dislike, and I think they're all pretty good. I mean, there've been characters in the past where I'm like, man, I wish they kind of get rid of that guy. That one's kind of annoying. Right now, I think I really like liking this cast.
Yeah, the cast is good.
Yeah,
the characters are good. Just not. I am hoping that I'm hopeful that they'll get past this plot.
Pretty quickly,
and then we'll move on to something new and different.
That would be nice. So we watched the first three episodes of Andor, the new Star Wars series on Disney Plus.
So good. It's really like it.
Very good.
You know, there has been almost no buzz about Andor. I don't think I've seen anybody talking about watching it on social media. Nothing.
Outside of Star Wars.
Outside circles. Of like particular, very hardcore Star Wars fan circles. But unlike like Book of Boba Fett, which seems to have a fairly broad appeal, it doesn't feel like anybody is even aware of Andor outside like the hardcore Star Wars fans.
It's wild. Maybe it will gather maybe there's some Star Wars fatigue. Maybe it's waiting to gather an audience. I don't know. It's kind of like it's disappointing. Part of the thing is it's been out. They recorded it so long. They recorded this like in 2020. It's been like 2 years since they filmed this version. It's not being filmed on the volume. It's being filmed on location. The volume is that special stage, the 360 visual projection system that they did Book of Boba Fett and Kenobi and Mandalorian on. But this was filmed outside on, you know, in locations. So, and it's got a real gritty feel. There's so far, there's no Force users. There's no The Force. It's all very, you know,
it's about so we saw Cassian Andor in Rogue One.
Yes.
He's very gritty character.
He's a rebel.
He's a rebel, but he's not really in the rebellion for idealistic reasons, it feels like. He's much more pragmatist.
You mean in Rogue One?
In Rogue One.
I
felt like he was kind of...
I wouldn't say that he's like, I think he's no longer idealistic. I think there are all kinds of people who join a rebellion. I think that's one of the things they were showing. Like you have the zealots like Saw Gerrera. You have the politicians like Mon Mothma. You have the starry-eyed idealists like Princess Leia. And then you have Cassian, who's sort of the gritty foot soldier who knows you got to get your hands dirty in order to get things done.
And he's done things that he knows are not noble. He
comes right out and says, you know, I've done things, you know, immoral things, bad things for this rebellion.
Right. So, I mean, he's no Han Solo or Luke Skywalker. He's kind of his own character arc, but, so this is more of his origin story.
Yes.
Which fills in some of from Rogue, you know, what we don't get in Rogue One. And I really like it so far. I think his character is really interesting. I really like what they've done with the storyline.
I think there's some other interesting characters, like secondary characters as well.
Very much so. And so it's early days of the Rebellion. It's about the same time as the Star Wars Rebels TV show. And I kind of like that, the whole gathering growth of the Rebellion, as opposed to the original Star Wars trilogy, which is sort of the late stages of the Rebellion.
The Rebellion is in full force, so to speak.
Right. So Luke is kind of he enters into the scene late in the game.
Right.
In Star Wars. Like, the Rebellion has already been going on for quite some time. And he's just kind of the latecomer to an already established
movement. Right. Whereas this is early days.
There is no rebellion yet. It's just isolated people resisting the Empire, but they haven't yet coalesced into something.
To something organized, an alliance. Right.
Because what we get is the Rebel Alliance. This is rebels before the Rebel Alliance. They haven't all come together as one fighting force.
Right. These are individual little groups.
Like cells.
Yeah. So anyway, it's really good. It's nuanced, I'd say, morally nuanced. It looks good. I mean, it looks fantastic and the acting is really good. So, Stellan Skarsgård is in it. The actress who plays Mon Mothma is really good. We're getting a more nuanced Mon Mothma. You know, we're getting to see her motivations, her origin a little bit. So it's really good. So we've been talking about She-Hulk on Disney Plus, Marvel She-Hulk. We've been continuing to watch that. And one of the things, the last episode we watched, we haven't watched the most recent one, but the one before was one where she was invited to an old friend's wedding, like a high school friend, I guess, who she kind of hadn't been in touch with, but she was invited to be a maid of honor.
Bridesmaid.
And it was very much a sitcom. I think we decided that's what She-Hulk is. She-Hulk is not a regular superhero show. It's a sitcom with contrived situations.
Very contrived situations. I felt like this one did not really do honor to her character. I felt like it undermined a lot of what they had already worked hard to establish about her.
Right.
I just felt like she was such a...
She was a doormat.
She was just...
Like, no one...
Let herself be walked all over without protesting or fighting back or...
Why would you put up with the things that she put up with? No one would do that. It was ridiculous. She was being bullied.
Like, she was being bullied by her friend at her friend's wedding, and I think any sane person would have just said, you know what? I don't need this. I don't need to be here. I'm going home. I'm leaving.
Especially since her friend is not someone she's actually friends with. It's someone she hasn't been in touch with.
I didn't understand what her motivation was supposed to be for sticking around.
Right. Frankly. So, yeah, it undermined the character, which is what happens in sitcoms. You know, they're not really aiming for consistency across, or aiming for laughs, and that's what we were getting. And I really feel like ever since the first episode where we had her and Bruce and her trying to figure out how to be She-Hulk without wanting to be a superhero, I thought that was interesting. I thought it was an interesting premise. But what we've gotten since then is just a series of what it would be funny if a young, ambitious female lawyer also had to be She-Hulk. Ha ha ha. I mean, I like the character.
I really like the character. I like the actress. I just don't feel like the writing is really doing her character justice.
Right. Or even the premise of the show. Like, just the what they're trying to do with the show is really doing it justice. So
they had an idea, and unfortunately they didn't know what to do with it. And it's kind of a waste.
Yeah. So
I'll probably keep watching it just because.
Yeah.
I do like the actress. I like the character, but I'm not very invested.
Yeah, same here. So we finished watching Hawkeye with the kids.
Love Hawkeye. It might be my favorite of the Marvel shows.
You say that
about everyone.
You say that as we get to the end of each one.
I really love it, though.
Like, because you said it at the end of WandaVision, you said it at the end of Loki.
No, I didn't say about Loki. Loki is definitely not among my favorites.
Really? Oh, okay. Well, in any case... But Hawkeye is really good. Watching it again, seeing how everything works. Of course, the best part of Hawkeye might be the last two episodes when Yelena shows up.
Oh my gosh, I love Yelena. She's the best.
That character is so funny, so awesome when she shows up. Just especially when she interacts with Kate Bishop.
Yes.
She keeps on her Kate Bishop.
I am very much looking forward to a Black Widow movie with starring Yelena.
Yeah, that will be good. They definitely should do that. Is there anything else to say? It was interesting trying to explain Kingpin to the kids who had not seen Daredevil. So
I haven't watched all of Daredevil, but I've watched
enough of it.
The first season and part of the second season, enough right. that I know who
that's
Kingpin
enough
is.
To understand
and to feel the menace and the scariness when you see him for the first time.
Yes, but for the kids, I'm not sure it has the same impact. So it's kind of interesting.
No, he's just like random guy who shows up suddenly, and he's right. the bad guy. But they don't really. I think if there's one flaw, it's that they don't build up. They really rely on you knowing Kingpin from other Marvel things, which I think that they could have done more to build him up. They wanted to keep him as a surprise.
Well, they kept talking about the big guy, the boss. The boss is going to come. Don't let the boss find out.
And I understand them wanting there to be that shock and surprise for the people who do know Daredevil, but you almost can't have both. You can't have the in-the-know fans get their surprise while also keeping the people who are newcomers clued in.
Well, it's going to be the same way with Spider-Man Homecoming with something. I won't spoil it for you.
Okay.
But there's going to be a moment where for those who have seen other Spider-Man movies, like the earlier ones, the Andrew Garfield and Tobey Maguire ones, where you're going to go, oh, wow, that's what the people are doing. Oh, wow. But if you haven't seen those, it's not going to have the impact. So I'm kind of curious how that's going to go.
So kind of like reading Magician's Nephew first.
It's like reading Magician's Nephew before the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which you should never do. Don't do that. It's not the way it's supposed to be. So anyway, so now that we finished Hawkeye, it's on to Spider-Man No Way Home. I keep doing that. Can never keep them straight. No Way Home. Home run. Home is out.
I thought we already watched No Way Home.
I don't know. Whatever is the last Spider-Man
movie.
No, we did
Far From Home. Homecoming, Far From Home. No Way Home.
No Way Home. Okay. That's what we're watching. So after that, it's Ms. Marvel.
I think the kids will really like Ms. Marvel. It's fun.
But after that, what do we watch? Do we watch Moon Knight? Or as I like to call him, Night Monkey?
I don't know. Moon Knight's really
kind of dark.
Dark and kind of scary.
It is. Did we watch She-Hulk?
No, I don't think it's appropriate for kids.
No, it's not. So I guess we're done with Marvel for the moment, right?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, and I didn't think that Thor: Love and Thunder was very good or really appropriate.
Not really appropriate for kids either. Yeah. Neither was Doctor Strange. The Multiverse of Madness, that was not appropriate for kids.
I forget what wasn't appropriate, but...
Oh, the zombie raising from the dead, evil at the end.
Right.
Without, I'm trying not to spoil it, but... Yeah. Of course, it makes it difficult, because when we do want to watch upcoming Marvel things with them, and they haven't seen these, and then it refers to these... So I don't know. Anyway, so we have to figure out what are we going to do? What are we going to watch with them after we're done with Marvel? We'll just start watching other movies,
I suppose.
Back to the Future, like classic movies.
Maybe. I think we need to pre-watch them, because I don't think that you remember all the stuff that is not kid friendly in some of these movies.
Well, that is true. That is a common problem for my generation. We're like, oh yeah, yeah, that movie was awesome. I watched it when I was their age. Oh my gosh, I watched that when I was
their age. You watched the edited for TV version when you were their age.
No, I mean, I saw Back to the Future in the theaters. But
for some things, there was the edited for TV version.
Like the James Bond movies and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
James Bond is cool. Anyway, we'll have to figure out. We're going to make a list of stuff. Yeah, all right. So let's talk about some books. I finished a book. Yay! So I read a Star Wars novel called Shadow of the Sith by Adam Christopher, and it takes place between Return of the Jedi and Force Awakens, and it's the story of how, well, it's kind of the story of Rey's parents, her, as we find out in Rise of the Resistance as a ride at Galaxy's Edge. Galaxy Quest, which would be an awesome theme park. Let me just put that out there. Right. So as we find out in Star Wars Rise of Skywalker, Rey's father is a clone of Palpatine.
Did we find that out?
Yes.
I don't remember finding
He's a failed clone. So, cause he doesn't have the Force powers. So we get their story and how Rey ends up on Jakku with Unkar Plutt, the big fat guy, and how they're pursued by the guy Ochi of Bestoon, whose ship they find in the desert, and they have the dagger that is improbably have the clue to finding the Wayfinder, that whole thing. So we have that story, but we also have how Luke and Lando are involved with trying to help them escape too. But it also explains why they don't recognize Rey when they see her. As the little girl from the, cause yeah, anyway, it suffers from a problem that a lot of these novels have set in this time period around the movies, is there are elements of these characters that apparently Lucasfilm doesn't want explored until they've decided whether they're going to include that in a movie or in a TV show or what. And so you have things like Lando having a daughter who was kidnapped. This is hinted at in Rise of Skywalker.
I thought it was more than hinted at. I thought it was pretty clear that she was
his daughter. I think so too, that there was his daughter. It's also in the secondary material. There's like the Rise of Skywalker source book or something like that that comes right out and says it. But it's implied that the young woman who is the former stormtrooper in that might be Lando, in fact, Lando's daughter. But in any case, this talks about him and his search for his lost daughter. But they completely ignore who is her mother. Like, they don't address it. It's not hinted at, not brought up, zero. And it's clear to me they're doing that because the author was told, do not go in this area. Do not touch that area. That is a forbidden area because we either have plans for that, or we haven't decided on what's going to happen with that or anything like that.
If it was me, I would just say, then fine, I'm not going to write that character or that story arc, because that would drive me nuts.
But then you wouldn't write the book. Then you find someone who would. That's the thing, is they want the story written. But this has come up before in other things as well. And this is part of the fact that Lucasfilm is hyper concerned with continuity and making sure everything fits in every medium, books, graphic novels, video games, movies.
You could be concerned with continuity and yet give the author the freedom to be the person who creates the continuity.
But that's the thing is there are things they let them do, but there are areas where they have decided this is an area we don't want you to go into. I know. It's
for bad storytelling.
I think that's the thing is it made for a, not a bad story, but it made
no bad storytelling.
Yeah. It was a bad element in this story. It was a flaw in the book. Other than that, it was interesting. It was cool to see Luke acting as a Jedi. That was pretty cool. And, it suffers from the problem of, you know, where everyone has to end up. So it sucks a little bit of the drama out. You know that Rey ends up on Jakku. Her parents don't succeed in getting away from the Sith. You know, that's just, you know, a reality. And so there's a little bit of lack of drama as they're trying to escape. Like, well, they don't. So the only question is how do they not, you know, succeed. But other than that, it was a pretty good story. So you've finished a couple books this week.
I have.
A much anticipated one.
So much anticipated was Naomi Novik's third book in her Scholomance series. The first book was Deadly Education, then The Last Graduate, and then this third one was The Golden Enclaves. And I've been waiting for this book for a while. It was really good. It had a couple elements that I didn't love. Some stuff that felt like it was put in there just to satisfy the sort of dictates of the YA genre.
Interesting.
But they were minor and I could kind of just headcanon them away a little bit.
Okay.
But on the whole, the way the twists and turns, the plot kept going in directions I did not expect. In very satisfying ways. It surprised me multiple times. And the final ending was satisfactory in a way that I was hoping that the series would wind up in a satisfactory way. And I really didn't know how it was going to do that. And it did so in a way that I couldn't have anticipated. And I was happy with that.
Okay.
One thing I consistently like about Novik is that she is hard for me to anticipate where she's going to go.
Yes.
With a story.
I was just saying that last night because I've started reading it and I was saying, well, obviously this is, I'm not necessarily obviously. I was about to say, well, obviously this happens, but maybe it doesn't, you know, she's unpredictable. She's.
And yet everything that she did that I didn't expect was better than I could have anticipated. Like, it was more satisfying. It wasn't like she kept pulling the rug out from under my feet in a way that left me unhappy. It was more like, yes, this is not what I expected, and this is better than I could have expected.
Right.
So I really like that about her storytelling. It's a dark series.
Yeah.
And the darkness continues through the third book. But in a way that's satisfactory. Not dark.
Not super. No, yeah. I mean, dark.
Dark is in the evil is really evil. The monsters are real monsters. And the characters live in a world that has been shaped by. I mean, you could say it has been shaped by trauma. It's been shaped by living in the presence of evil.
And there's a high body count.
And the way that societies shape themselves when something horrible has happened, like in the wake of a revolution or the way American society continues to be shaken by and shaped by our experience of slavery. Like horrible sins have repercussions that last for generations. And I think that that's what Novik is exploring in this series is the way that people misusing power has long-term impacts in ways that they couldn't imagine, they couldn't anticipate. And it hurts their descendants. It hurts innocent people.
You're veering close to spoiling me, so I'm going to stop you there.
I'm not going to.
No, I know. Actually, I'm putting things together in my mind as you say that with things that I've been reading. So that's okay.
That's been a theme since the first book.
Yes, it has been. It is a world in which, children are at risk on a regular basis because of who they are, because there are creatures that hunt down people who have magic, and these creatures are really good at capturing them. It's kind of like the movie with John Krasinski and Emily Blunt where you have to be quiet.
I don't remember. I never saw that one. I don't remember what it was called. The Quiet Place?
The Quiet Place. Thank you. Where there's this ever-present evil danger that you have to just... It's always around the corner, and people are constantly getting killed by it. But
I get the feeling that in The Quiet Place, the danger is external. Like, it's aliens who came from somewhere else.
It is.
Whereas I think one of the things that makes... the world of the Scholomance different is it's pretty clear from fairly early on that most of these evil monsters that are coming for the kids are the result of
magic gone bad.
Magic users who have deliberately used their magical gifts in ways that are destructive, the ways for evil, or have done unethical things, and there are repercussions for those unethical uses of magic. And I like that. I mean, I like world building where evil deeds have evil repercussions. Like, you don't get away with doing bad, and there's no fallout for it.
Right. J.K. Rowling.
Right. I mean, it's a sort of ethical realism where the ethics feel grounded in a moral reality.
Yeah.
So then I also read a book which was slower and harder to get into. It's the sequel to The Golem and the Jinni, which I really enjoyed. And it's called The Hidden Palace. And it's got a wide range of a huge number of characters that you met in the first book. And it takes a long time to build tension. There's a lot of just sort of what happens to these characters after the end of the story. And tension grows until... like, I was like at 85, 90% of the book, and I'm thinking things got really bad really fast, and I have no idea how they're going to pull out of this. And is this going to be a book that ends on a cliffhanger? And then it did resolve in a way that I really liked, but it did build much, much more slowly than The Golem and the Jinni. And so I think that might have been a kind of a weakness.
Mm.
But it was a good book. It was worth reading.
Okay.
And then I feel like I read something else, and I cannot remember what it was.
In the last 2 weeks? Yeah, I'm sure you have. You finished your Goodreads challenge.
I finally finished my Goodreads challenge for the year. I have read 52 books, and I'm still going strong.
Bragger. So, I'm way behind. So that's where we're going to end things this week. I mean, it's been a long week, and we've already talked for an hour. Like I mentioned, I will append at the end of the recording my reading of my brother's eulogy for my dad. I hope it's edifying, enjoyable for you. If you choose to listen to that, and let me know what you think. But before we get to that, I'd like to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including Alan and Melissa K., Masij B, John L, Paul L, and Yvonne R. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets and all the shows at StarQuest. And you can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. So you'll find links from our discussion in our show notes at sqpn.com/bets. That's BETTS. Send us your feedback at the StarQuest Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia, or send an email to bets@sqpn.com, or visit the StarQuest Discord community at sqpn.com/Discord. Follow Raising the Bets in Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, your favorite podcast app, or at the StarQuest YouTube channel, where you should also make sure to hit the bell to get notifications. Until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest. The following is a reflection written by my brother John on the occasion of my father's funeral mass. This was read by John, and it's in his words, and was read at the end of the mass. First, on behalf of the whole family, my older brother Bernardo, Francesca, Dominic, Evelyn, Amanda, Angela, and Christina, their spouses, the grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, I want to thank everyone for coming today. Domenico Bettinelli. He was kind, smiling, a man of hard work, a man who would give people the shirt off his back if they needed it, a man who learned what it meant to love and be loved. I could easily come up here and tell some of Dad's stories that we all know, but we know them because he told us over and over and over. I'll start with a couple of his quotes, though. It costs nothing to be nice to someone. When someone would ask him how he was doing, he would almost always answer, "Now that I've seen you, fantastic." And then one of his greatest quotes was, "Has anyone told you they love you today?" We are here because of love. We know that my dad, Domenico Bettinelli, loved greatly. He loved his family. He was so blessed to have his two sisters and two of his brothers still with him here at 89 years old. He loved his big brothers. He was so proud to talk of Frank and Benny. He loved his sisters. He loved playing cards at Josie's house. He loved talking of Josie's love for Uncle Luciano. He would talk of how Josie took care of him when he was dying at such a young age, and how his two sons, Peter and Bernie, showed their love for their dad, not with just words, but loving care. Dad loved his two sisters and his big brother that have gone before him to God. He loved his mother and father. Dad would proudly tell the story of the love that he came from. He would tell the story of his dad, Bernardo, born in 1889, coming to this country as a young boy, not a young man, but a young boy, all by himself, and how love brought Bernardo back again and again to the love of his life, Francesca, back in Sicily. How they married and had Tina and Jenny, and how Bernardo kept traveling back and forth between the United States and Sicily in a time before planes and jets. Bernardo would work and fish out of San Francisco and Alaska and then travel all the way back across the U.S. by train and back on a ship back to Sicily. They had six babies between Jenny and Joe, but tragically they died. In 1928, Bernardo, Francesca, Tina, 12, Jenny, 10, Joe, 2, and Frank inside his mom came to the USA. They settled in the West End of Boston and Bernardo fished out of Closter. Benny was born next, then Domenico in 1932, then Marianne and Josie. There was lots of love in his family of origin. Dad loved work. He would tell the stories of selling papers on the streets of Boston at a very young age. He went into the bar rooms and sold papers. As was noted in his obituary, he went to work right after high school at Raytheon in Waltham. He then joined the military following all his big brothers. He was in the Navy like Joe and Benny. He loved telling the story of serving on the aircraft carrier, the Bennington, with his brother Benny. He also loved telling the story of going to Fatima in Portugal and how he met the father of one of the visionaries who saw the Blessed Mother in 1917. Dad tells how he passed the hat among all the sailors present to give the dad a donation. Dad loved his faith. Dad loved God. Dad was not a saint. Through his life, he grew in his faith every day. As we know, as Catholics, the dead who are with God in heaven are saints. There are angels that were created by God to solely watch over us, but our call as human beings is to be saints. We were created to be with God for all eternity in heaven. Dad knew that. He would share that some of his earliest thoughts of faith in God came at St. Joseph's Church in the West End. He loved stopping by. He loved going up to the choir loft and listen to the beautiful music during the Mass. I can picture that little young Sicilian boy sitting there with his heart being drawn up to God by the beauty of the singing. Dad was not a saint. He was living his life's journey, and that journey took a number of turns. He would always say that he was the black sheep of his family. He was the prodigal son. In Scripture, we hear of a separated sheep that the shepherd goes out to find. We hear how the shepherd will leave the 99 and go find the one to bring them home. He will return with that sheep on his shoulders. Dad was being pursued. Dad's life took lots of twists and turns. He was a sinner like all of us, but even in that sin, he loved and tried to love. My mom, Virginia, and Dad were married for 25 years. They had 5 kids. They tried to raise us in the faith. One of my earliest memories of faith was at Mass at Blessed Sacrament Church in Jamaica Plain, and hearing my dad sing at Mass and seeing his really powerful hands on the back of the bench in front of me. They taught us to pray before bed and before meals. Dad wasn't around a lot. He worked a lot. As most guys his age, he felt those 40, 50, 60 hours a week of work was his way of loving. Dad wasn't perfect, and he ended up leaving my mom and my 4 siblings and I. The pain from the divorce that was brought into my family was horrific, and those were really dark days, months, and into years. Divorce can be really painful for the children, even 30, 40, 50 years later. Those decisions can still affect so many. Dad did love again. He loved Mary Ellen and their 3 daughters, Amanda, Angela, and Christina. I, too, had been the black sheep of my family. I, too, was like the prodigal son and tried to live my life my own way and not the way God wanted for me. During that time, I literally didn't see my father for almost 3 years. I got involved in things I shouldn't, but God was pursuing me as he was also pursuing Dominic. During those years when Dad was first remarried and his daughters were really young, I was given the blessing of discovering God's love. I learned about confession and how God had forgiven all my sins. I just needed to go to him. I learned about the true presence in the Eucharist. I then figured if God could forgive me, then I could forgive my dad. So I called him up because I wanted to share with him this new love I had for God, and I discovered that he had for us. Dad and I met, and Dad listened, and we shared back and forth. He was totally open to it. Not too long afterwards, 30 years ago, Dad's heart failed for the second time. He was 59. The doctors told us they had to do a quintuple bypass, and Dad had a 10% chance of surviving. Then his wife, Mary Ellen, showed my mother, my siblings, and I a total selfless act of love, and she said if we wanted to come in to say goodbye to Dad, she was okay with that. At the same time, Dad asked me how he could be right with God. I went to my priest friend, who went to the cardinal, and asked what Dad needed to do. The priest met with Dad for about an hour before the surgery. We each got to say our goodbyes to Dad. He obviously survived, and his life was very different from that day forward. He returned to the church. He became a daily communicant. He loved serving the church. He would open up St. Matthew's in the morning. He loved reading his daily devotional and scripture book, The Magnificat. He tried to be the best dad he could be to his young daughters, to his 5 older children, and to his wife, Mary Ellen. Mary Ellen was very open to Dad trying to juggle all the relationships. He traveled to Steubenville with my family, including my mom, to see my brother Dominic graduate from college. He traveled to Rome with my sister Francesca, Dominic, and I back in 1999. He loved all that we saw and did. He saw his faith in such a deeper way. He saw that we stand on the shoulders of all who have gone before us in faith. He loved all the churches. He loved the statue of the Pietà of the Blessed Mother Mary holding the lifeless body of Jesus. As life went on, he and Mary Ellen were dealt a very heavy cross with Mary Ellen's sickness that took her home to God after almost 10 years of struggle. Throughout all of that, Dad tried to show her love in his care for her. It was so painful for him and the 3 daughters when Mary Ellen went home to God. That same year, he took a bad fall and ended up in the hospital and recovery rehab. During his recovery, we brought him in some simple junior high reader books on the saints produced by the Daughters of St. Paul. I believe that first night we brought 5 books. The next day, when I saw him, he was so excited. He had finished all 5 books in less than 24 hours. He couldn't believe the amazing stories of Maximilian Kolbe, St. Thérèse of Lisieux, and the others. He asked me for more stories. We brought in 25 others, and he kept devouring the stories of the saints. At this point in his life, he was given a gift. He ended up getting to move in with my brother Bernardo and his wife Carol. He and my mother reestablished a great friendship. It was a great gift for my mom and dad. He got to go to Mass daily with her when they could at the chapel in Brockton, and then here at Immaculate Conception when it was just him. Bernie got him a scooter, and he would scooter up the road here to the church, and if there was Mass, he would go, and if not, he would just sit out front, in front of the grotto statue of the Blessed Mother, and he would say his prayers. He would read his Magnificat book daily. He prayed for all of us here now, and all who have gone before. He was given the gift of a peaceful death. He was given the gift of someone praying the prayer to St. Joseph at the moment of his death. My daughter Teresa said when he died and stood before Christ, Jesus looked at him and used one of his quotes on him. He said, "Domenico, has anyone told you they love you today?" Jesus showed him his hands and wounds and embraced him and welcomed him to eternity. Dad would be the first to say he wasn't a saint, so he would want us to continue to pray for him. He wants to be with God in heaven, but he may still need our prayers to shorten his time in purgatory. If that's the case, then we need to keep praying for him. This morning, when I was saying my morning prayers, I was wondering if God could give me a gift of knowing I was heading in the right direction for this reflection. I picked up the Magnificat book like my dad would every day, and today is the Feast of St. Jerome, who died in the year 420. And this was part of today's meditation written over 1,600 years ago, and it could have been written today for my dad. The Savior himself came not to call the just, but sinners. For those who are healthy do not need a physician. And he wishes the repentance of a sinner rather than his death. And he brings home the poor lost sheep on his shoulders. And when the prodigal son returned, his father received him with joy. He to whom more is forgiven loves the more. And at the same time, the angels in heaven rejoice over the safety of one sick sheep. And if anyone thinks this is not right, let him listen to this coming from the Lord. Are you envious because I am generous? God was generous with Dad. Dad, throughout his life, God pursued Dad. Dad learned to love and be loved. He was a kind man with twinkling eyes. He was a man who loved.